previously on Willing to Adapt.
Today, we are not only talking about the book Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, we are talking about the Disney 1951 movie Alice in Wonderland. There are a lot of controversies and not really mysteries, but questions in regards to Lewis Carroll and what may have been going on in his head when he was writing this book. And I think, for the most part, a lot of them are just dumb. At the end of the day, there is no evidence against him, no matter what people say.
Yeah.
I think all we need to really say on that.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I think the way that you have to look at it, at least for Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, is they were directed to the specific listeners. Either the mathematician, like, co-worker, but mainly the girls. And so when he does reference real life things, it's things that they would have known and recognized and appreciated in a story that was specifically meant for them.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of people nowadays try to look too much into things because they think that Lewis Carroll's trying to write something in a way that's, like, subversive or speaking about real life situations or people, whereas that's not what he was intending with this book. All right, did you enjoy the book?
I did.
You didn't sound very...
So, for me, I enjoyed Wonderland, but I got bored a little bit in it, and in certain stories.
Well, because there's nothing that really connects each little episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what works for this is when you think about it as I'm reading this before bed.
Yeah.
So I'm just going to pick it up and see, oh, what's going to happen to Alice next time?
And that's kind of how I read it. I would read a chapter, finish the story, and then move on.
I'm Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt.
Alright, welcome back. This is the second episode in our Alice in Wonderland episode. In the first half of this, hopefully, if you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it, because there's a lot of good information there.
Yep. Yes, there is.
But we talked about the book and Lewis Carroll in that episode, and then in this one, we're going to talk about the 1951 Walt Disney film. And we'll just jump right into it.
Let's go for it.
Romy, when is the first time you watched this film?
I believe the first time I watched it, I was definitely preteen.
Man, you weren't even like a child?
No, because it wasn't something we necessarily rented, because I don't remember it being... Remember, I think in a previous episode, I talked about how my dad would rent videos and we'd watch...
Yes.
Okay, VHS.
Yeah.
And
or
so,
the library.
Or the library. And on this particular one, I'm pretty sure I watched it for the first time on The Wonderful World of Disney.
Okay.
Yeah.
I missed that.
Yeah.
This was a film we had on VHS.
Okay.
But also because I grew up going to Disneyland, like, I was very familiar with the two attractions, and I think we just had a lot of Disney movies. I did not realize that this film did not do well when it came out.
I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't read that part.
This film was a critical and financial failure, essentially. It did not make up what it was spent on it.
Wow.
I think they said it spent $3 million on it, and it only earned $2.5 million. So it came up short.
Wow.
Yeah. Huh. And we'll talk about that. But I was shocked about that.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of heard a little bit about that, but when I started looking into this episode, I realized how much it did not do well when it came out, which is sad.
Yeah.
But remember, Walt Disney kept going back to the princess movies, quote-unquote princess movies, because those were the ones that kept making him money.
Mm.
So he kept making other films. Like, he made this one, he made Peter Pan and other things, and they weren't making money. And so he was like, gotta make another princess movie.
Was Peter Pan before or after this one?
After this one.
Because the same
yes.
voice actress yep. did both Wendy in this one.
Yes. Okay. Alice in Wonderland is a 1951 American animated musical fantasy comedy film produced by Walt Disney Productions and released by RKO Radio Pictures. It's based on Lewis Carroll's 1865 novel Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, and its 1871 sequel, Through the Looking Glass. It had voices of Ed Wynn, Richard Hayden, Sterling Holloway, Jerry Colonna, and Catherine Beaumont in her film debut. As you were saying, she went on to do the voice of Wendy in Peter Pan. It essentially has a very similar plot to the book. A young girl follows a rabbit through a rabbit hole into a nonsensical world called Wonderland, which is ruled by the Queen of Hearts, while encountering strange creatures including the Mad Hatter and the Cheshire Cat. So, Walt Disney was supposed to make his first film, Alice, which was apparently going to star Mary Pickford, who was a huge name for her time, as Alice. But he chose not to do the film. Instead, he did Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And do you know why?
No, why?
So, Walt Disney had attempted to make an Alice film multiple times. And when he first started, he did his Alice short films that were very loosely inspired by Alice in Wonderland. He always loved the book. But in the 1930s, other adaptations did not do well. And when he was trying to make, Alice as his first full-length feature.
Mm-hmm.
What ended up happening, I think it was Universal made a live-action version. And it basically bombed. Like, it was so bad.
Wait. Universal made a live-action of
Alice in Wonderland. I don't remember if it was Universal or which company it was, but a different film company made a version
for theaters?
Of Alice in Wonderland. No. Yeah, oh. For movie theaters, yeah.
Oh, but back in that time?
In the 30s, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was in black and white, and it did not do well.
Have you ever seen it?
I've seen clips.
Oh, okay.
It's a little nightmarish.
Yes, really?
Yes. Like, the puppets and things they use are just really creepy. And that was some of the things people did not like about it.
I can see how you can make that creepy, yeah.
Yes.
Alice in Wonderland can lend to the creepy if you let it.
Yeah, and so technically, the Walt Disney Company had been working on Alice for about 20 years or more. Just, you know, with breaks in between. And the story changed a lot in that time. Originally, it was much closer to the book. And Walt Disney thought it was too close to the book.
I thought I read it was supposed to be a live action first.
He went back and forth. Yeah, went back and forth. He was thinking maybe live action. And then he was going to have it so that Alice was live action, but everything else was animated. And...
Did you see who the original author of that script was supposed to be?
Oh, yeah, Aldous Huxley.
I was like, what?
I know. I know.
For those who don't know, Aldous Huxley wrote Brave New World.
Yep.
Very different. Very different than
yes.
Fairy Tale of Wonderland.
Yes. But it went through many different hands, basically. Like, many different writers and designs. And some of them were really dark and creepy. And some of them were just way too realistic and close to the book. And, yeah. Anyway, without going too much into that, that was partly why he ended up making Snow White instead.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. Which is kind of funny because people have also said on the record that when Disney made Snow White, it was part of the reason why MGM realized they could do Wizard of Oz. Because they realized there was a market for fantasy stories.
Oh, okay. So you mean from an audience perspective.
Yes.
I'm trying to think. I thought you were referencing like technicality. Or
no, that's just a random
like
throwaway
yeah.
a bit of information for you.
No, that makes sense. Because how often do we see the gluttony in Hollywood of a certain topic until people are tired of it? Like Star Wars or Marvel.
Anything. It's
like, yeah. Or
yeah.
Musicals or whatever.
Yeah, they're creatively bankrupt right now. I have quite a bit of information here. I'm just going to go at it. And if you have something to jump in, please do. I'm going to look to you every once in a while for something. So Walt Disney wanted the story to be more accessible to children. He also said he wanted to create a story for an American audience, not an English audience. He did not care if there were many changes to the story as long as it had the feel of the story and included the fantastical elements of the original story. Like, he still wanted to feel like an Alice in Wonderland story, and he wanted it to be consistent with the main plot lines, but he didn't care if there were major changes.
Okay.
Yeah. And he eliminated entire scenes, including the one with the Duchess, like I mentioned. And almost all of the events are rearranged for the movie, and many more comedic moments were included.
So the Duchess is not even mentioned once in
the Disney version, no.
The rabbit doesn't mention it.
Okay. Nope. In fact, it's interesting because I thought about this on the drive over here, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it from Walt Disney's perspective, which makes sense, I'm going to be straightforward. I grew up with this movie. There's a lot of nostalgia for this movie. It is a lot of fun. And I was introduced to the Alice... Disney version first. So I have that bias, I'm going to admit. Mm-hmm. Having said that, from a creative standpoint, because I will admit, I think I would have a rough time if I grew up with the book and loved the book.
Oh,
and
yeah.
then watched the Disney version. I think I might have a hard time with
it. It's like growing up with Harry Potter and then seeing the movies.
Right.
Or sure. Lord of the Rings or any sure. of those type of books. Yeah.
Sure. Kind of. It's different. But I think that's part of the reason why the movies were not successful at first. Because mm-hmm. a lot of the critics of the time said he changed too much. He made it too American. He mm-hmm. took out a lot of stuff that people liked in the original story. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Thing, you know, of that nature.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
And I will say, from a creative standpoint, when you're trying to simplify an extraordinarily episodic and intellectual story
mm-hmm.
and create something for mainly children,
yeah,
Disney was successful
yeah.
in that it still feels like an Alice story,
mm-hmm.
just a different shade of that story, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. You see that a lot in...
Yeah.
Disney. I mean, that's Disney.
Yeah. And I'm very aware that there are other adaptations out there that I do not like that.
Yeah.
And so, like I said, I think I will admit that there is a bias there.
Like the rat's a name.
Yes. Yes.
Go back and listen to that episode. That's anyway. One of the ones where we really disagree on.
But one thing I noticed on the drive over here specifically, like I was saying, that I was actually very surprised about, and it makes sense. When you're trying to condense an extraordinarily episodic and intellectual story into like an hour and a half,
mm-hmm.
you have to eliminate things. Like, there's no way around that.
Yeah.
You will have to eliminate characters. You will have to eliminate scenes. But you have to maintain the key scenes.
Yes.
Like, you, for lack of a better term, we'll call them cornerstone scenes. On one level, there are certain scenes and characters and elements from the original story you really cannot do without. You cannot have an Alice in Wonderland story without the White Rabbit, because she needs to follow the White Rabbit down the rabbit hole. And obviously you need Alice, because she's Alice, right?
Yes.
And I realized they were cutting characters that they could do without because they did not matter to the plot as much.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense. Like, the Duchess actually did not matter to the plot that much. She adds something to the story, but she's not important enough to the plot.
It happens in Harry Potter a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the Disney combined characters gave characters more screen time.
And I think that's why I'm glad I read the rest of Looking Glass after I watched the Disney, because I had, I'll admit, it was a little fun seeing dialogue that was given to other characters in the Disney one. And I was like, oh my gosh, that was spoken by the Mad Hatter. Oh, that was the king or whoever.
Mm-hmm.
Or the queen. Sorry, it was the queen parts. Yeah.
Yes. And so when you look at it, like you had to keep the Cheshire Cat mm-hmm. because the Cheshire Cat comes multiple times and is too important to moments in the story. And the Walt Disney version kind of just expanded on that character a little bit. But by erasing the Duchess character, the Cheshire Cat now no longer has an origin story. And so the Cheshire Cat just, like, appears.
Yeah, no. I saw that. Because it makes... I actually had forgotten. Because since I read the story, watched the Disney version, it wasn't until... And I actually had forgotten... Actually, no. I watched the Hallmark version, the old 90s version, and then I watched the Disney version,
mm-hmm.
and I had forgotten the ownership of her, which mm-hmm. is also addressed in the other version.
I love that in the Hallmark version, the Cheshire Cat is Whoopi Goldberg.
That was unique, yes.
But it makes sense, and we'll talk about it a little bit more, but it makes sense why they kept certain characters in the story. Like, they had to keep the Mad Hatter and the March Hare and them in the story because, one, their scene is way too iconic.
Yeah,
you cannot get rid of that scene. Which, that scene apparently was not in the original book.
Which scene?
The Mad Hatter, the Mad Tea Party. It was not in the original book.
Wait.
It was, I think, in the expanded, like, public version. It was not, I don't think it was in the version that was written for the Liddell sisters.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, okay. So I'm like, I read the authorized Norton critical edition version. It was in there. No, I see what you're saying. Okay. Because I forgot. You're right. He did add and he did some corrections and other things as time went on.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
By the way, then, so the Mad Hatter, the Mad, because they show up at the end.
I know. I was thinking about that. I don't know. Interesting. I don't know what the changes were, and I couldn't find what had changed.
Yeah.
I just had known that he had changed things. Huh. And I knew that. Someone had said that specifically. I came across that.
Okay.
But... I'll just jump back into it real quick. Here are some of my notes. Disney's Alice in Wonderland is on record for being the most musical of Disney movies. I think they said there were over 30 songs in that movie.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of songs were cut.
No, there were a lot of songs that were cut.
Yes. Are you referencing some of them all were of reused. Those?
No.
Okay. So just a little.
No, within the actual movie itself.
Because you know how Disney came out with like special editions that had all the cut music from their movies? I was hoping there was one. I read that. I was hoping there was one for Alice. And apparently the first soundtrack for Alice came out in the 90s.
I didn't know that. It's weird.
Yeah.
Yep. Nope. No. Like when you watch the movie or listen to the soundtrack, some of them are short, but there's so much music in Alice in Wonderland.
Okay. I caught on that.
Yeah. In that, when you look at other Disney movies, there's the story and then there's intermittent songs. In Alice, it's almost as if the music carries the story.
Okay.
Which I find very interesting. And I think it helps. Because the music's very fun. But other than that, the Disney version is far more energetic and it maintains a good momentum. Whereas when you look at the book really feels slow. Did you feel that?
I did, yeah. That's why it was, like you said, it helped to read it in stories.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there was always energy in the Disney version. Like, characters were always moving. There was always things happening. And there was always kind of like some goofiness.
You know? She was more bossy in the Disney version.
You think so?
I felt she was less whiny, more bossy. Because in the...
I don't think she was more bossy in the Disney version.
She had that kind of childlike boom, I'm stomping my foot on the ground and like pounding her head. I'm this is frustrating, and then kind of moving on. So it was a childlike.
I don't know. I feel like she deserved it at that point though. That was more like around the caterpillar section though.
Yeah. But even with the queen,
she'd been through a lot,
she did, but she was like she got frustrated a lot, but I felt it was unlike the story where I got annoyed with her because she was more whiny and she was like, I don't know my name. I don't know where I'm at. Who am I?
I think part of it is also when you're reading it, you're kind of interpreting it yourself. And then this is
true.
You're watching someone's interpretation of that.
And I like the way the Disney version interpreted her character better. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then one big thing is the Disney animator Mary Blair. You know Mary Blair?
I do. I've never met her, no.
I don't think she's alive anymore.
I'm just kidding. I have no idea who that is.
Mary Blair is a Disney animator. She did a lot of work for Disney, mainly in like the late 40s into the 50s. She mainly is the designer for It's a Small World at Disney.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
But she did a ton of work for Cinderella and a little bit for Peter Pan as well.
Okay.
But... her designs are what convinced Walt that it was possible to make this movie, essentially. Because her designs are so specific and very fantastical and a little illogical.
Yeah.
She had traveled with Disney to South America during the Goodwill visits around the time of the Second World War. And some of her designs are actually byproduct of what she had encountered down there with the different cultures and their designs.
Hmm.
Like the bright colors and the different designs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But she was like essentially like the head designer, like all she was the creative designer for the film. Like her aesthetic was what made that film, Alice in Wonderland. And so because the story is very episodic, there were essentially different directors for each section of the film, which meant that they all did their best to outdo one another in the quality and et cetera.
Mm.
And you can kind of see that a little bit. There's definitely some sections that feel different than others.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have a cohesive director over the whole thing. Right?
I think so. I'm reading it right now as you're...
It's funny because at one point I even noticed her bow on her head. is always black, but in one scene where she's mistaken as a serpent, it's blue.
Oh, when she goes through the tree?
Yeah. At one point, it's blue. And I was like, oh.
That's funny. I missed that.
One other thing I wrote, and this is very difficult to explain because even reading it, I don't quite agree with my own writing. The film seems to eliminate a lot of the general randomness and illogical moments, and it streamlines events, and it moves Alice in and out of different places with strong motivations. It did introduce new funny random moments, though. So, like, whereas the original story had a lot of very intellectual, illogical, random bits that they just really expanded upon, the Disney version had a lot of comedic, random, funny bits that had nothing to do with what was happening.
True. It fit the time. I mean, you see that in a lot of Disney films, I feel, especially with the background animal characters.
Oh, my gosh. My favorite scene, though, is the Mad Tea Party. It is so funny. It is, like, nonstop funny.
Yeah.
You cannot look away from that scene because there's so much happening. Like, with all the jokes of, like, all the different teapots and how he's pouring things and stuff like that.
Or the half cup and...
Yes. Yeah. And, like, none of it spills out. Or he hands... Like, she's always trying to get tea, but she never gets the tea. Like, he keeps taking it away. Or he goes to give her a teapot, but it has no spout, so she's shaking it.
So, let me ask this. Do you feel that Disney dumbed it down?
Yes.
Okay. But...
I hate to say it, but yes.
But it was in a way that... Because here's something, a thought that went through my head, and this kind of fits into, I'm sure I went off on this diatribe in past podcasts, on the, like, it's no, everyone knows, society has gotten dumber as time moves forward. You know, I know an evolutionist, Stephen Jay Gould, I think, wrote a book on that, and I've read so many different aspects as how society has kind of dumbed down.
There's a lot involved in that.
And so... as I was reading Alice in Wonderland, I was thinking to myself, if I were to read this to a kid today, would they even find an interest in it? Because especially if they're hooked on electronics and screen time and all that other stuff. But in watching the Disney version, I will say I didn't think he had, like, even though he may have dumbed it down, I appreciated it. I felt there was still a brilliance to it. But I can't put my finger on what that brilliance is.
I think when you say dumb it down, I agree with you in that it's not mathematical in like the book, and it's not very intellectual like the book is, but it's still very clever.
Yes.
And it's not stupid.
I don't know if this is because I'm thinking...
Like, there's new wordplay.
Yeah.
Like, there is new funny wordplay that is very clever that's not in the book. And so I think it's one of those things where it's different.
And because I think what I'm kind of alluding to as well as the modern critique of Disney movies that they sanitize. But I don't think he's necessarily sanitized anything. I think he just brought it for the audience of his time, which still translates to the audience of our time.
I think it's one of those things of he was trying to reach a specific audience, and that specific audience was mainly children and mainly American children.
Okay.
And so that's why he didn't really care so much of maintaining that very English aspect of the novel. He wasn't trying to stay true to... Like, I'd been very angry if someone did Jane Austen, but, like, changed it and so it was, like, very Americanized, because that's very specific to a culture and a time period.
Yeah.
But because Alice in Wonderland is so fantastical and exists within its own ridiculous, nonsensical world, it doesn't matter as much.
Yeah, no.
But...
Because I'll be honest, it's been such a while since I've seen the movie, I was prepared to be a little bored.
Oh, no. Oh.
And because I remember when we watched Sleeping Beauty, I was blown away by the animation. I will say the animation was not quite at the same level, but it was still very beautiful.
Nothing is on the same level as Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah, I know.
Because they took great pains and took a lot of time.
Yeah. But I was still blown away. Like, my favorite scene was... whenever the introduction or the going away of the Cheshire Cat. Only because for the first time ever, I caught what he was singing.
Sure.
And I was like, I get that. Because I've read the first line of the poem Jabberwocky.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the first time, I was like, I get that. And it, mm-hmm. I loved that. That endeared it even more so to me just because they threw that in.
It kind of felt like Alice ventured into a new Wonderland.
Yeah.
Like, it still felt like Wonderland.
Yeah.
But it was like a different rediscovery of it, mm-hmm. if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And because he wasn't, yeah, I don't want to be a dead horse. So I will, okay, going back real quick. Mm-hmm. So this is one I thought was fun. There's so many things I notice when we do the podcast because I'm looking for them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not passive viewing anymore.
Yeah.
One thing I really liked, and it makes sense from a story standpoint, Alice's goal changes in the Disney film. In the book, she follows the white rabbit into the rabbit hole, but then she very quickly kind of stops caring about the white rabbit. In the book, her goal turns into trying to get into the garden.
Yeah.
She can't get into it first because she's too big. Mm-hmm. And then she gets sidetracked and she's trying to get back to it. In the end, she does get to it, and it belongs to the Queen of Hearts. But she kind of goes on a couple different adventures after that, and so it's like, you reached your goal, like, you know what I mean? But that's not the point of the story. But in the movie, her goal is constantly to find where the white rabbit is going. Disney even added the white rabbit into multiple scenes just so that she can follow him out of those scenes. Like, specifically the Mad Tea Party scene.
Oh, yeah.
They added the white rabbit into that scene.
Okay.
So that when they throw him out after singing the unbirthday song, mm-hmm. it gives Alice a reason to leave that scene.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So there's a lot of motivation in the movie that the Disney team gave to Alice to leave scenes that is not in the book. Did you notice that?
I did. I mean, I didn't pick up until you mentioned it, but now that you mention it, yes, now I see that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I like that. I think it's fun. Mm-hmm. And it helps lead the audience into the next scene, too.
And speaking of the tea party scene, I did not pick up until I mm-hmm. read the scene later and through the looking glass that they never once mentioned unbirthday, which is like such a Disney icon.
I know.
Iconic.
It's hard to think about that scene and not think unbirthday.
Yeah.
Right?
And yet it's not in the original story.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Humpty Dumpty is the one who actually brings it up to her in Through the Looking Glass.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So I'll jump to that real quick. The Mad Tea Party was completely changed in almost every aspect for the Disney film. The main change was obviously, as you said, the unbirthday party. And I put, maybe it was because Americans don't have tea time. And I said, or Lewis Carroll was very intellectual and sometimes long-winded in that scene. And so by making it simply an unbirthday party, it was easily understood. And you didn't have to explain it. It was just, it's an unbirthday party. And everybody got it, you know? And so you didn't have to explain how in the original book, it's tea time because it's tea time forever because the characters, the Mad Hatter and March Hare, angered the character of time, right?
That's right. I remember them talking about meeting time.
Yes, and so time made it so that they had to be at tea forever, basically. Which is why it's set out for so many.
Yeah.
Because they don't have time to clean the cups and stuff, and so they just lay out a huge table and just move on to the next one when they're done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's not explained in the Disney version. It's just more just comical, like, nonsensical.
Yeah.
But, you know, many of the additions that are in the Disney version are actually because of the fun the actors had on set when they were modeling for the animators.
Oh, okay.
So, Catherine Beaumont, Edwin, and I can't remember the other one who did the March Hare, they all did the live-action scenes for the animators. And they were just, like, all messing around. And Edwin comes from vaudeville. He came from vaudeville. And he just went at it. Like, he just had a bunch of fun. And the fun fact is what you hear in the film is actually all the recorded dialogue from that.
Oh, wow.
Okay. When they were doing that scene, that was never supposed to be the dialogue that was going to end up in the film. Like, that was just stuff they captured with him messing around.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I kind of wondered about that, too. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of the great comics have done things like that.
Robin Williams did all the time. Yeah. And so That's why, like, in Mrs. Doubtfire, Chris Columbus had, like, 30 cameras on him at all times, because he knew that Robin Williams would ad-lib.
Mm-hmm.
And so Walt Disney was watching them do that scene, the live testing for the animators, and he was telling them, like, this, we need this. And so they brought Edwin back in to re-record the dialogue exactly, but mm-hmm. it wasn't nearly as funny because it wasn't off the cuff.
Okay.
And it felt too forced. And so they had to go into the original dialogue that they had recorded, and they had to, like, heavily clean it up and get it professionally prepared.
That's funny.
But yeah, so if you listen to that scene, that's all stuff that was directly taken from that.
Hmm.
So it makes some sense because it's all over the place.
Yeah.
But it's so funny. He just came up with a lot of that stuff. Do you have anything, or do you want me to keep moving?
Go ahead.
All right. So characters for me. Characters in the book seem more antagonistic and frustrated with Alice than in the movie.
Definitely.
In the movie, they generally kind of have more fun with her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are definitely characters who are frustrated with her.
Yeah.
But I've always noticed in most of the scenes where there's a bunch of characters, there usually tends to be at least one character that is somewhat sympathetic to her.
Mm-hmm.
And the one big example is in the Golden Afternoon number.
Yeah.
It's the Red Rose.
Yeah.
The Red Rose is very affectionate to Alice. And even when all the other flowers turn on Alice, she's, like, shocked
mm-hmm.
that they're doing that. But in the book, that doesn't happen. Like, in the book, all the flowers just don't like her.
Yeah.
And I thought that was interesting. I was wondering why, because I couldn't find any reason. The only thing I could think of was, I think maybe just so that we continue to like Alice.
I kind of wondered if it was the standard idea of adults being annoyed with the child. You know?
I don't know.
I mean, maybe it's reading too much, but I kind of... Because if he's telling this to a kid, a lot of times, and I find that this is an overdone trope in children's lit, is the adults who don't understand or who just don't get it.
Children should be seen and not heard.
Yeah, well, in children's lit, it's like, yeah, it's kind of the thing. Like, I was watching a Disney movie with my wife today, and she made a comment at one point, and she's like, why does the mom not just listen to her daughter, you know? Mm. And I was like, well, then the movie wouldn't have happened.
Nope.
So it's, I kind of wonder if it was something along those lines, since he was telling it to a kid. Mm. You know?
I don't know. I got a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Can you list the one character in the Disney film that is brand new to the Disney film? That's not in the book, any of the books.
The one character.
Mm-hmm. There's one character that does not appear.
The doorknob.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
The doorknob was a brand new character Disney created for that scene.
Yes.
Yes. Do you know why?
No, I have no idea.
It's something we've encountered before with Coraline.
To further the story?
It's so that she doesn't talk to herself the whole time.
Oh. Because I noticed that in the live action one, they just had her talking in her head.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then, especially in that scene, yes. She talked to herself a lot in her head.
Yes, she does.
Okay. That makes sense.
It's mainly so she doesn't talk to herself the whole time, mm-hmm. but it's also so she gets some guidance and it picks up the pace.
Okay.
Because the doorknob is the one suggesting things to her.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious. The way they wrote the doorknob, it felt like it should have been in the original story, the way they wrote him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the thing about how, like, she grabs the doorknob and it's his nose.
Yeah.
And he's like one good turn deserves another, you know, stuff like that.
He was in, going back to another podcast, he'll be
directly
of ours,
directed in the right
he
direction.
He was in Roger Rabbit.
No.
Yes.
I no,
will
I
look
don't think
it up
so.
To prove it to you. Go ahead.
No, because that movie came out after Roger Rabbit set in.
No, it was.
Technically, Tinkerbell's also, so. Anyway, one other thing is, in the Disney version, the character of the Dodo takes on a much bigger and a consistent role in the movie.
Yeah.
Whereas in the book, he's actually such a minor character. And part of the reason why his character was expanded is because a lot of other characters were eliminated entirely.
Okay.
And I thought part of the reason why Disney expanded on the character of the Dodo is... if only because that species is extinct.
Yeah.
And what I thought was really funny is I was looking up dodos and I was laughing because when you look at how the dodo is dressed, he's dressed like he's from like the 1700s. Yeah. And that is when the dodo went extinct.
Oh, is that when they went extinct? Okay.
Yeah. And so it's like, oh, he's dressed when they would have gone extinct. That's pretty good. That's clever. So you like thought went into this.
You know? Yeah. No, Disney has had or has good story writers. Mm-hmm.
Usually. They used to. Mm-hmm. All right. Some small things. When Alice is stuck inside the White Rabbit's house, Bill goes down the chimney to get rid of Alice. That scene's changed a bit. Bill is now like a chimney sweep and doesn't work for the rabbit. He just kind of appears. And it's the dodo that actually like pressures him to go down the chimney. I don't know if they were just trying to make the White Rabbit more sympathetic or friendly or what. But like the White Rabbit was definitely more fearful and less high and mighty in the Disney version.
Yeah. So going back real quickly, in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the doorknob can be briefly spotted right at the part where Eddie Valiant twists his nose and closes the door to an unfinished bathroom in order to get away from Nina Hyena.
Oh, I do know what you're talking about.
I don't know why I remembered that.
Mm-hmm. But you know what I thought was funny is, you know, in that scene...
He's also on Kingdom Hearts.
I'm sure he is. You know that scene in the film when Bill's going down the chimney? And then Alice starts to sneeze and she kicks him up the chimney by accident.
Well, in this one, she just sneezes him off the chimney.
Sure.
But in the original, I think she kicks him, right?
On purpose.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. In the Disney version, they made her a lot... They eliminated moments where her character kind of lashed out at the other characters.
Yeah, because in the original books... They mentioned temper a lot, mm-hmm. you know, about holding her temper. I can't remember if she mentions it to the queen or not. Does she in the Disney? I hate when they start kind of blending together in my head.
I know. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting how, and then like another small one is like they're just quickening the pace, right?
Yeah.
In the book, the way she grows smaller after being stuck in the house mm-hmm. is they're throwing pebbles at
her. Yes, I remember.
And the pebbles turn into little biscuits mm-hmm. that she eats and she grows smaller. But in the Disney version, she eats a carrot out of the garden and that's what makes her smaller.
Just kind of random.
Right. I mean, it's random, but it makes sense with the logic of the book.
Yeah, no, it does.
But it also streamlines it so you don't have to explain any of like the stones changing and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The movie also raised the stakes a little bit and made some more conflict. Actors in the movie definitely ad-libbed. All right. And then can you explain this to me? Because it's been a very long time since I read through The Looking Glass. Mm-hmm. When in the movie she goes to the Tolgi Woods, mm-hmm. is any of that in through The Looking Glass? Like any of the creatures or things?
No. I specifically looked out for them. So the most they talk about are rocking horse flies. Mm-hmm. And those are bread and butterflies.
Well, that's stuff in The Golden Afternoon.
Yeah. But none of that is in... Because the most they did, there was a conversation she had, was it with Humpty Dumpty, in which he explains some of the words from Jabberwocky. Mm-hmm. And so they talk about... He explains what a Mothrab is and Gimbal and Gyre and those type of things. And sure. Slimvi or whatever. Other than that, no, that was all Disney. And it was a very, I thought it was kind of a unique Disney thing to put into a movie. It reminded me of some of the other cartoons and animated stuff I've seen from them of that era.
You know, it was very interesting because I was confused about that as well. When I was watching, I was like, are any of these from the book? I don't remember any of them.
They mentioned the Mothrabs.
Sure. But they're very clever.
Yeah.
Like the creatures they came up with are very clever and funny. But they also seem too goofy to have been in the books.
Yeah.
But when I was thinking about the movie, the way that they were writing the movie, in that they were trying to lead up to Alice like kind of having a breakdown. Mm-hmm. It kind of made sense that they're just throwing a bunch of craziness at her in the woods.
I kind of felt it was the obligatory, not that she's a princess, but the obligatory animals coming to the aid, or at least to listen to the princess scene. Because, I mean, they remember how she starts crying and then they all mm-hmm. kind of gather around her and listen. It was
and then
very,
they disappear.
And then they disappear.
Yeah.
But it's very like reminiscent because of it some of the other movies.
That it's her imagination.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, spoilers, she was asleep the whole time.
Yes.
But it's like all the things that kind of scared her, like they start to feel bad for her because they're kind of experiencing her emotions with her, mm-hmm. and then they just disappear.
Yeah.
But they disappear like when she starts to get very introspective and realizing like she's gotten herself into this predicament herself. Yeah. I got really angry at someone. Someone was a very opinionated on a YouTube video, and they were talking about how Alice is like a very empowered feminist character. And then they were very angry that she needed to receive help in that scene from the Cheshire Cat because she couldn't do it herself.
Yeah.
And I was like, you need to calm down. I was like, because if I had said something about that from, like, a man, you would have been calling this, like, toxic masculinity or something. I was like, people need help sometimes.
Yep, everyone does.
Anyway, just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, no, I did like, that was one of the scenes where I felt it was very Disney's, mm-hmm. very Disney edition.
Well, and it made sense for their version, because if her goal is to find out where the white rabbit went, mm-hmm. and she's slowly becoming more and more overwhelmed by everything she's experiencing.
No, it was definitely a tool to move the plot along.
Right.
And to bring her to a resolution of her breakdown.
Well, and she kind of kept rejecting. Like, she would kind of interact with things that were happening in the movie. Mm-hmm. But she always kind of rejected fully engaging in it because she was frustrated by it or she didn't understand it or mm-hmm. whatever. Or she felt like she wasn't getting attention or something. But by the time she gets to that scene, she actually has to engage with like the Cheshire Cat to get the help. And then once she's actually in the garden of the Queen of Hearts, mm-hmm. like she's engaging and like she's helping to paint the roses and stuff. Yeah. Like she's actually like now actively engaged in what's happening instead of being just caught up in it. Like she's mm-hmm. actually purposefully doing things.
Yeah.
Which
makes sense.
It kind of, I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it made some sense. All right. Another quick one. This is something very common in a lot of adaptations of Alice in Wonderland. A lot of people tend to confuse and or conflate the Queen of Hearts with the Red Queen from Looking Glass.
Yes, and they're very different.
They're very different. The Red Queen in Through the Looking Glass is supposed to be like the Red Queen on the chessboard, right?
Are we going to talk about the other one separately or no? Or just should I just bring it up as...
You can bring up whatever you want about the Looking Glass, but...
No, for the other Hallmark one.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll briefly talk about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the just to kind of briefly, Alice in Wonderland was playing cards. Through the Looking Glass is a chessboard. One of the things I thought was interesting, though, is most of us think of chess as black and white. In this, in all the versions, it's red and white. So, yeah, and I think that's why people confuse the Red Queen with the Queen of Hearts. Two different names, two different women, I guess. Two different queens.
Well, and the Queen of Hearts in the book has very little power, but she's, like, all talk and all show.
Yeah.
But she's actually not that bad so mm-hmm. much as she's just annoying, really.
Yeah.
Whereas the Red Queen actually is kind of antagonistic.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
And yeah, because
you know every movie has to have an antagonist, right? So
yes, it's not like I know I've seen other versions of where they do more from the Looking Glass, where they've made you know they tend to make the White Queen a nicer person,
mm-hmm.
whereas they're just different personalities in the story.
Right. So another big one.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say one of the biggest changes that happens near the end of the movie?
Near the end?
Yes.
The court case?
Yes. So in the book, the trial is Jack or the Knave of Hearts
stole some tarts.
He stole it's a nursery rhyme, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, he stole some tarts from the Queen of Hearts.
Queen of Hearts, made some tarts.
Yes. And so everybody has to go and it's like a stupid trial where it's like the tarts are there. Like
mm-hmm.
Like it's just dumb, and Alice ends up just being fed up with it, and she's like, "You all are just a pack of cards," and then she ends up waking up from it, like when she stands up for herself, and she's like, "I'm done with this," you know?
Yeah.
In the Disney version, though, the Cheshire Cat reappears like he usually does during the croquet scene, but he instigates and creates it so that she gets in trouble with the Queen of Hearts,
mm-hmm.
and so then now Alice is on trial.
Yeah,
and. Which, you know, from a story standpoint, it works really well because it's kind of true to the original and that there's mm-hmm. still a trial. It raises the stakes and it creates much more conflict. And, you know, when you're using kind of traditional storylines for a modern audience, you want to build to something. So,
yeah.
I think it was a smart move for them to mm-hmm. do that. it didn't work out very well for her. I think it's funny because in both versions, Alice, when she stands up for herself in the end at the trial, mm-hmm. that is when she wakes up.
Yeah.
Which I kind of like. Mm-hmm. Which is like, she points out the logic of the situation or the lack of it. Mm-hmm. And she grows really tall and she just points out who she, like, that she's done with it basically, right?
Yeah.
In the Disney one, she still does that, you know, end with a bang kind of. And I kind of liked it from like an emotional standpoint. Mm-hmm. And it's much more climactic. All the characters are chasing Alice, trying to behead her.
Yeah.
While she revisits basically everything that she had encountered previously. Mm-hmm. Which I actually liked. But I kind of liked it also from the standpoint of when you think about it, it's very fever dream.
Yeah.
And it really starts to point out you're asleep. Mm-hmm. Because it all just blends into each little segment while they're chasing her. And the whole trying to opening the doorknob.
Yeah.
And he's like, you're already on the other side. Take mm-hmm. a look. And she's like, I'm asleep.
Because I think in Alice too, the original story in Wonderland, she doesn't realize she's asleep.
She does not realize she's asleep. In the original book, she says, you're all just a pack of cards. And then all the cards like start to fall yeah. onto her. But then she wakes up because her sister is brushing some fallen leaves off of her.
That's right. And then she tells the sister. I remember there was yeah. a whole paragraph on she told the sister the story. Yeah,
that was a little weird at the end of the book.
Yes.
It was kind of like this idea of like, you can create Wonderland for yourself, mm-hmm. kind of. Because it was like, Alice explained the story, the dream to her sister who was older, and the sister like sent Alice off to tea, but then the sister started to imagine Wonderland and all mm-hmm. the characters. So in a way there was still a revisit.
Yeah.
And the sister was imagining all the characters and stuff in a way that she like really kind of felt it. Mm-hmm. And then there was a weird, I don't know, meta moment where they're like, and Alice would grow up and would always remember Wonderland, and she would tell her children about Wonderland
yeah.
and stuff like that. So then, it was interesting because it was like, I don't know what he meant by that. I'm sure people have always written things. I kind of viewed it more as like, Wonderland is the childlike imagination in all of us that we can create for ourselves.
Mm-hmm. I think he even addresses it in letters to, like in the Hunting of the Snark, he had wrote a letter to the children who were fans of Alice, in which he talks about, I read the letter, I remember he talks about child being, you know, being a child and stuff like that in imagination. But in the Looking Glass, she actually knows, she kind of implies she knows she's asleep. So that's one of the big differences in that particular one, which led to a philosophical question when she finds the Tweedledee, Tweedledum, how do you say it? They come across the Red King, and it's, you're just part of his dream. And at the end, am I part of his dream? Are we part of his? Who's really dreaming? But it added to the philosophicalness of the latter story. One of the things I picked up that I kind of wondered if it was meant to be is when the White Rabbit is calling her Marianne. And then later on, I think it was Humpty Dumpty and Through the Looking Glass, he talks about he implies all humans look alike. So I was wondering if that was something, you know, I was like, in my mind, I'm wondering like, oh, so to the rabbit, she's just another human. And that's why to him, she's Marianne. And I was wondering if that was the implication was to other creatures, humans are all alike. Since to us, all rabbits look alike. I don't know if I was reading too much into it.
Well, did you have any other thoughts about the Disney film?
Not that I can think of right now.
Did you look into why the movie ended up becoming popular?
No, I did not.
It's quite funny.
Why?
Can you guess?
I mean, I assumed it had to do with the cult classic. I have no idea.
All right, I just want to see if you can guess. What kind of happened during the 60s?
Oh, drugs.
Yep.
Okay. So, really? So that's what led to the popularity?
Yes, so...
Interesting.
In the 60s, because of the quote-unquote head movement, mm-hmm. And all the drugs and stuff that was happening with the countercultural movements and stuff, especially on college campuses, the request for private screenings and rentals of Alice in Wonderland on private universities and colleges mm-hmm. soared.
Interesting.
Because people would do drugs and watch it.
Makes sense.
And yeah. So Disney became aware that the rentals were doing really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so they actually finally re-released Alice internationally in the beginning of the 70s.
Wow. I didn't know that. Huh.
And so there's a very psychedelic looking Alice in Wonderland poster from the early 70s.
Doesn't surprise me.
Yes. And so then it just became a part of America's collective consciousness.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's also the two attractions at Disneyland, but still.
Which I did read the original voice actress came back and helped with it. I don't know what she did.
Catherine Beaumont narrated the attraction.
Does she?
Yes.
Okay. And I know she even came back from Fantasmic.
She did the voices for Alice up until the 90s.
Okay.
And then I think she might have passed or got too old.
Mm.
Yeah. Like, I think in Kingdom Hearts, it wasn't her.
No. I just read her name as in the credits of Fantasmic and the Dark Ride. Is that what they call it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. But I thought that was really funny.
Yeah, that is.
So I guess we can be glad that it became popular because of that, I guess. I don't know how I feel about it. But, okay. Well, I think that's all I have to say about the Disney version.
Next time on Willing to Adapt.
We weren't going to talk about the 90s Hallmark made-for-TV version, really, because I wasn't sure if you were going to watch it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really prepare much for it, but I think we can talk about it very briefly, just because I think it's really worth mentioning.
Yeah, no, definitely.
It's not quite the highest caliber.
I actually got a kick out of watching the way they interpreted the costuming,
right?
and makeup. Yeah.
Yeah, the 1990s made-for-TV version on Hallmark, back when Hallmark actually meant something and not just romantic comedy that all have the same plot formula. It had a great cast.
Yeah.
My gosh, how did they get all those people? Mm-hmm. I do not know.
Who's the better Mad Hatter? Edwin or Martin Short?
That's not fair.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please like and subscribe. Maybe leave a review or just share us with friends and family.
We would also love if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromi@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.